Welcome back to another episode of the Shop and Chivalry Podcast. My guest today is a familiar guest if you're from Ocean Springs. He's also a second-time guest on this podcast. His name is Shay Dobson. Shay and I talk about his time as a mayor in Ocean Springs. His tenure ended earlier this summer. He was succeeded by Kenny Holloway. We talk about his time briefly as mayor, and we talk about the election cycle that had just transpired. I was a bit more involved in that than I had ever been with this podcast. We also talk about COVID, among other things, but Shay's really here to talk about his Citizens Alliance for Mississippi. Now, the catalyst for this was the recent Initiative 65 proposal that was up for the general election in Mississippi, which has to do with medicinal marijuana. Now, I do want to make it clear, his organization is not about simply propagating medicinal marijuana, but rather what Shay wants to do is create an organization that holds state politicians accountable to their vote and as well as to their constituents within the state. He talks about his idea to provide a report card on how state legislature and the members of the legislature vote. And he wants that to be available for all citizens. It's a really great idea. And we talk about that, again, amongst other things, including the Tennessee Titans, which will likely make a pretty strong Super Bowl run this season. But in any case, it was a great opportunity for us to catch up and talk about his organization and his goals for the future. So without further ado, everyone, please welcome Shay Dobson. All right, man. Are you ready?
Yeah.
All right, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of the Shop and Chivalry Podcast. I'm here with the great and powerful Shay Dobson. Welcome back, buddy.
Thank you. Yeah.
Yeah. So this is your second time on the show. First time with video. Last time was in my garage.
That's right. Yeah. I was trying to think. I was trying to remember. I've been on many podcasts, so I couldn't remember if this was my first or second or second or third time.
Yeah.
If I'd been on one or two. But you got a great setup, and I'm glad to see how you're progressing and
it's been fun, man. It's been fun. So Shay, obviously, we won't dive too much into what people can check out on another episode. Obviously, we talked about you being the mayor and that has that's come to an end, right? A new mayor has been elected.
Yep.
So what's it like being a former mayor of Ocean Springs?
Yeah. Well, it's, I still try to keep in touch with folks from City Hall and different, aldermen and the mayor and I try to stay as informed as much as possible about what's going on. I'm dealing with, state politics and state issues right now. So, just trying to, kind of have one foot in each, but at the same time, let the new administration and the new guys really own, what it is they're trying to do. And Kenny, I'm happy. I think he's been doing a good job so far. We'll stay in touch here and there, and he'll let me know if he can't find, some pens or something around. I'll let him know where the pens are in the office. But no, it's I try to stay in touch with most of those guys and stay out the way enough, but then be there if they need me, if they have any questions or want to pick my brain on something.
Yeah, is Kenny a Titans fan?
No, I think
it must have hurt
fan.
To kind of. Oh, really?
Yeah,
I'm sure it hurt to take all the memorabilia off the wall as well.
Yeah, Bobby Cox enjoyed it. So, we actually the Titans and the Saints actually play this coming season, the week 10, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, so it's gonna be a good season for Tennessee. It's a great time to be a Titans fan.
It is. If we can just get our defense looking average, at
small
least.
small holes, But
yeah, well, we were 32nd last year, so
we gotta
31st and we'll be an improvement.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Well, because of the whole, high pass offense that's kind of run through the NFL recently, defensive backs are in short supply because defensive backs typically have like a shelf life of a running back. Like they're not in the league very long.
Yeah.
So, they're really in short supply. I mean, that's really what did the Chiefs in, so.
Yeah. What I like about how the Titans are built right now is Derrick Henry is such an anomaly. Most running backs are more, they're usually shorter. Derrick Henry gets better towards the end of the season and at the end of games. And so defenses, like the trend has been on offense to get faster, get smaller. And so defensive has kind of responded. And then you put this bull like Derrick Henry and he just you know, he just runs through them.
Yeah, and defensive backs and running backs are typically similar stature. So, you know, a stiff arm from Derrick Henry on a guy that's 6'1".
Josh Norman.
Yeah, it's... That's the one. So
that's my favorite.
Yeah, yeah. Well, he went sideways in the picture, and yeah. I made a comment. I was like, Derrick Henry hit him so hard that he turned him into a photographer because it looked like he was leaning back doing one
like
of those.
Like the Patrick Mahomes throw.
Oh goodness!
Yeah,
but
I enjoy it.
Yeah, yeah. It's gonna be a good season. But so the former council. There's I think Jennifer Burgess and Kevin Wade are the new members, right?
Yeah.
So. Outside of those two, there's some experience that they can bring over to the new administration. But surely, especially with COVID having a higher kick-up rate, Kenny must be reaching out saying, hey, you know what, at least what was your thought process here? Which it must be a benefit to have you still in the city and willing to kind of, you know, help out where needed.
You know? Yeah, you know, I talked to him, I think it was last week, and we kind of... discussed a little bit about what's going on. What I'm glad to hear is, from what I understand, whenever COVID just started in 2020, all the mayors on the Gulf Coast, and Billy Hughes, to his credit, Mayor Billy Hughes of Gulfport, he organized it, and it was just it was actually twice a week. We would all do a Zoom call and, you know, kind of give each other updates and share best practices and stuff. From what I understand, they've actually started that again. And
that's
so
good.
I'm glad to see that, but you know, he's working with Lee Bond, the CEO of Singing River, and you know, Lee is amazing, and I know Lee's going to steer him in the right direction. So you know, I'm confident we're in good hands. But yeah, we kind of discuss more about just kind of experiences and kind of you know, how to handle it internally and such.
Yeah, it's interesting because this was something where there's nobody we could reach back to in our lifetime that said, "Hey, how did you guys handle the last pandemic?" So in some sense, you know, when the numbers started dying down, they can actually reach back to some people who went through this in a similar fashion, and that experience is hugely valuable because outside of this time last year, there's nothing until 1918.
Exactly. Right? Yeah, we have so much. Even though there's so much we don't know, there is some stuff that we do know, you know, now, that as opposed to a year ago. So last year was more, you know, just reacting. But this year, obviously, we got the vaccine, and, you know, there's obviously debate on that. But at least it's available and people can make a choice, and people and you know, it's there for those who want it.
So. Yeah. Yeah. So you had COVID.
I did. Yeah. Last year.
Well, so.
It wasn't bad for me. Of course, I didn't have the Delta strain, so you know, back when I had it, so I can't really speak to that. But yeah, I had it. In fact, I was looking back, and I think it was in like August, so it was right at a year ago now.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I had very mild symptoms. It wasn't too bad for me. But you know, now that I got the antibodies, I feel like I can fight off any other variants, at least make it to where it's not as bad.
Yeah. What do you make of the numbers coming out of Ochsner and Singing River that shows that you'll have anything from like a 90% plus people that are actually in the hospital are unvaccinated.
Unvaccinated, yeah.
Is that enough of a case to be made for you should probably go get vaccinated, or what are your thoughts on that?
It's a good, it's definitely a good argument for sure.
Yeah.
You know, I think everybody needs to assess their risk and, you know, talk with their medical provider. I watched a good, you know, it's been, the whole thing's been so politicized. You don't know which source to trust.
Unnecessarily politicized, yeah.
But I do trust the organization TED.
Okay.
And so they actually put out a video. I subscribe to their YouTube channel, and they put out a video, like a 5-minute video the other day. And it kind of explained how this new vaccine technology is different from the old. And I'm not even going to try to explain the science because I don't know, but it sounded really good and it sounded very promising. So, you know, I think that there's a lot of, I think with that vaccine, it's a lot easier to get it to where you need to be in a shorter amount of time.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that rightfully so makes people uneasy because it's new and,
yeah, it's novel. Yeah, I mean,
and so yeah, we're dealing with something like you said that just is unprecedented. But I've always been a big, you know, I've always been a fan of vaccines. I got my flu shot. It's funny. I was actually talking to a friend the other day, and when I first got in office, like within a year of me being in office, they talked about getting the flu shot, and you know, I think it was, I can't remember which organization. I don't want to speak out of turn, but they were holding a clinic for all of this. It might have been Singing River Health System, actually.
Okay.
And you know, they were just talking about wanting the need to promote the flu shot and all this stuff. And so I would get on like social media, like took a picture getting my flu shot and stuff like this. And and so I've always been pro vaccine. I'm kind of like, well, where are y'all at? Like a lot of these folks, like, you know, the flu has been around and we've had the vaccine for that.
Yeah.
And so I don't know. It's just it's kind of frustrating because, yeah, I think the vaccine is very much needed. And people, a lot of people do need to take the vaccine, you know, based on their health risk or, you know, a variety of issues. But, you know, my thing is that, and I'm not perfect. I'm not going to say I'm nowhere near perfect. But, you know, Mississippi hasn't been is known for not being the healthiest state in the world.
Sure.
And, you know, just American society in general, I mean, we have a lot of work to do. And so, you know, we can debate a lot of the, we can debate whether vaccines are good or bad. That is up for debate because look, the vaccine's not FDA approved.
Sure.
From my knowledge. I mean, unless there's been breaking news.
Not yet.
And so, but what we, I don't think anybody should refute or at least say they don't agree with or whatever is, you know, we need to get healthier. We need to eat better, you know, stuff like that. So I think that as far as COVID and, you know, people needing to, you know, wanting to watch what, you know, their health and a lot of that stuff, it's like, wherever you are in the vaccine, at least try to use this as an opportunity to have better habits, form better habits, you know, eat better, go exercise. You know, I'm not saying you have to go every single morning, be a gym rat, but, you know, ride your bike, you know, go for a swim. Park at the end of the parking lot and walk to the
small stuff, right? You know? Yeah, exactly.
Just stuff like that.
How about put your cart back?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, that's a pet peeve of mine. Yeah.
Who'd have known? Now, there's probably a case to be made that it's better for your health if you put the cart back.
Yeah, I like that. Yeah, put the cart back and exercise your heart a little bit.
Yeah,
yeah. But
I do think that's a problem with, say, the mindset, whether it be political or just the ideology of, say, freedom. And it's that, you know, in America, we're free. We're free individuals. We're free to, you know, choose and do the things that we wish to do. We are the masters of ourselves. The individual is the fundamental building block of this country, right? Mm-hmm. Individual sovereignty. And yet people stop there. But I think in order to have that comes also incumbent upon that is the personal responsibility.
Yeah.
And so if you want, for example, I'll use New York because they like to protect people from themselves. Yeah. So they outlawed the 44-ounce drink, right?
Oh, yeah.
But that's a rule that's designed to protect people from themselves. Now, if people were a little more conscious about what they put in their bodies and their health and diabetes and how that's going to create long-term problems for their kids as well, it's going to create generational problems. People should take the personal responsibility to not do that. But it's as if, no, I'm free. I'm an individual. You can't tell me what to do. Great, fine. Mm-hmm. Well, there's a personal responsibility you have. And I would go so farther. I kind of was talking about this last year when the mask mandates came out.
Yeah.
It's like, well, I mean, it seems like they're doing that because people are refusing to participate in a collective, we'll say, experiment to lower the rate of transmission of COVID. Mm-hmm. And so people are saying, well, no, you can't do that because we're free and this and that, and it infringes upon our rights. I don't personally, you know, subscribe to that. Mm-hmm. But to me, it's part and parcel to the same thing. And it's that, you know, you want freedom, but you don't want the responsibility that comes along with it.
Right. No, I mean, you have a lot of good points. And I think, you know, I remember when I first got into politics, I would always say, well, I'm socially liberal and fiscally conservative.
Sure.
Now I say I'm just socially moderate. Because there's been some things that the liberals have gone. I'm like, well, I can't agree with that. But anyway, I say that to say that I give my conservative friends a little bit more credit these days because I've come to realize is that, you know, we need as much freedom as possible. But I think what comes with freedom is, you know, morals and convictions and, you know, and institutions, social institutions that encourage people to, you know, be virtuous and act in a gentlemanly way and this type of thing, you know, a polite society, this type of stuff. I think what also goes along with that is that, you know, the more you have government in institutions kind of blurring the lines the way I've described it is blurring the lines of whether it be the government taking care of insurance, you know, mm-hmm. you don't have to worry about getting insurance and planning for your future because if something happens, you know, the government's going to have it. The government's going to take it. And so I think a lot of times in American society, we haven't had to think in those terms. We haven't had to think in personal responsibility because, you know, daddy government has sure. got us. And so, you're absolutely right. As far as, you know, some of these things, not necessarily being an infringement and being just something that you should, whether you're required to do it or not, you should be willing to do, or at least open to do. But I actually blame, frankly, the government and more of the ruling class and elite, because they've, number one, they've blurred the line so much. Nobody knows, you know, what's up or down. You know, nobody has to really, and that's, you know, in my opinion, what kind of the broader argument against socialism and communism is, and such like that, is that you don't have to take responsibility for your actions anymore. And not only that, you look, you rewind back just less than a year ago before the November elections, and you had Kamala Harris and all of these progressive candidates and elected officials saying, we'll never take the vaccine. They hated and distrust Donald Trump so much, they kept feeding that fear
sure.
and pushing that fear. So my question is, what do you expect?
Yeah.
You know, what do you expect? If we would have had a society and a government that respects people to agree to disagree, you know, had more economic freedom, had institutions that, you know, says, look, you're willing to, you are free and allowed to pursue your dreams and, you know, think out of the box, but you also have to accept the repercussions that come with that.
Sure.
I just think that a lot of this would, you know, you would still have people agreeing to disagree, but it would be a lot less toxic, I think.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting in recent years, I've kind of become, I don't know, allergic to the hypocrisies of the political dichotomy in this country between the right and the left, red and blue, what have you. And I'll use what you just said as an example, where you said that the progressives would say you don't have to take personal responsibility. I would say the conservatives are cut from the same cloth, just perspective is different. And it's saying you can't force responsibility on me because I'm free.
Yeah.
You know, and so I see them very much alike. And again, my contention is that actual productive conversations in this country are not found at the extremes of that dichotomy, rather at the margins.
No, you're right.
You know, so, and unfortunately the political atmosphere, and I saw this at the local level too this year, it seemed that at the margin, nobody wanted to take a step towards,
yep.
you know, it seemed that they were entrenched in their camps, and perhaps that's a product also of the competitiveness of being American and, you know, wanting to win and being a team player. I get that.
Yeah.
But there is an element of that didn't sit well with me. You know?
Yeah, I understand.
And it seemed also that the greater national politics and the dirty game that is permeated the local elections from what I could see to some degree, got me to the point frustrated enough that I described some groups as being Gestapo like in their activity, and you know, I've got to take responsibility for that, obviously, but
no, you're absolutely right. I think one of my main additions to that is that the national toxic political atmosphere didn't just all of a sudden enter whenever municipal candidates announced they were running in 2020.
Sure.
It was literally the day the polls closed when I got elected. So,
yeah, you dealt with a firestorm from the very beginning.
Yeah, and so what you saw, frankly, is a lot of people online who spent four straight years, frankly, either straight up calling me and other elected officials Nazis, white supremacists, people who are simply flying a flag to encourage Nazis and white supremacists to come to Ocean Springs. This was the rhetoric that was all around Facebook in Ocean Springs.
And to your credit, when that was going down, you were saying, look, it's just a state flag. Like, yeah. And you weren't saying that you wouldn't, like you would, you wouldn't fly a different flag if it was elected as a different flag. Here's
the thing. They were so dense, and they couldn't see the forest through the trees at all.
Well, they got to stick with the narrative.
Yeah, because I came out and I said very clearly, in no uncertain terms, I'm flying this flag because it is the state flag of Mississippi.
Yeah.
Clearly. I don't care if you had an emoji on it, if you put this iced coffee on it, I would fly it.
Yeah.
I also stated that I think we need a new vote. I also stated that I would help get signatures for that vote. But nope. It all became is white supremacy versus the virtuous, open-minded, liberal progressives.
Yeah.
And so the thing is that, not only did all that stuff go on, it was 4 years straight on Facebook. And so some people will say, well, I didn't call you that. Yeah, but you know what you did is you would like it.
The people that did.
You would like it. You may share it. You may comment on it. You may do a laughing emoji that encourage it. That all that's doing is piling on.
Yeah.
And so what happened is you had all these people who spent 4 years doing that, trying to belittle, mock, and straight up attack myself and some of the other aldermen, frankly trying to make our life a living hell. I would wake up in the morning. Hold on. I would wake up, check my phone, and be tagged in, Shay Dobson is a white supremacist, blah, 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 blah. And so my question to them is, would anybody else like to have that happen for 4 years straight?
Sure, sure.
And so, I think a lot of people are taking a lot of things for granted when it comes to the local election because, there were certain candidates that, without overtly saying what they were doing, they were trying to cash in on a lot of that stuff. And they were trying to insinuate a lot of stuff without saying it.
And without getting into detail, I know this is true because a couple of reasons. One of the benefits of doing this podcast for the politicians is or the people running is that they all came into this room where you sat where you sat. And when the cameras turned off, I consider those conversations to be confidential, but I've told people, man, I wish I could write a book of the conversations that people have told me, just kind of behind the scenes of what's been going on. And I've had people reach out to me that let me listen to voicemails that were clearly directed at you from people from just out of anger, loads of cursing, name calling, things of that nature. And it just, I try to view things objectively and it completely changed my opinion on things such as the Mary C. Yeah. And really a lot of things that were contentious throughout your mayorship. And I do hope, much like George Bush, I think the history books are going to be nice to old, the old painter George Bush here, honestly. I do think that history is going to be kind to you as well. Cause I do think that what I've learned at least is the objective truth and that you were treated quite unfairly.
Yeah, and here's the thing. I mean, I wasn't perfect. I never claimed to be perfect. But what I tried to always do is stand up for what I believe in, regardless if I was, supported by only 10% or opposed by 10%.
Yeah.
Whenever I first got elected at the local level, I had spent about a year kind of, saying I'm almost like I don't know if identity crisis, but like as far as just like I'm so tired of national politics, so tired of all this other, like at least let me go to the local level where, we could talk about getting streets paved and not have to worry about all this.
Issues national, that shouldn't be political.
Right, right. Yeah, and so... Literally before the polls even closed or as the polls were closing before I even took office, we were inundated with that. And so it was just very, frustrating and, frankly disappointing the way that, not that these are important issues and we should disagree and we should disagree very passionately, but to use this kind of national, political playbook of divide and conquer and you did this, so you're a white supremacist and we're going to keep pushing the distrust and this and that. Okay. That's,
it's a reduction of issues down to an Excel, logic equation. If this, then that.
Yeah.
With no further analysis.
Yeah.
Beyond first order principles. And to me, it's not intelligent,
Not at all.
And quite frankly, if you have a different perspective, like you should talk about it. Like you should, you owe it to yourself, to your own courage, your own ego, to be able to voice those. But also, you owe it to yourself to be, I think, on the right side of things. I mean, I've got no position that I believe in that I will die holding. Yeah. I am always wanting to be on the right side of the actual argument, whatever that is. And I'm willing to hear anybody's perspective on it. Mm-hmm. And it just, it's hard for me to understand how somebody can wake up in the morning and not take that perspective. Like they're willing to be so entrenched in an ideology or a value principle that they're willing to be just grossly incorrect. Mm-hmm. You know, and I just, it's difficult for me to understand that.
Yeah. But I mean, last thing with the election, I mean, that was one of the most frustrating things. And like I said, I mean, all that stuff didn't start once people start announced their, that was what frustrated is, you know, during the election, you would see people, well, you know, this election has brought out all the bad out of people. And, you know, I can't stand politics, or they would blame this candidate or that candidate for things getting ugly. And this, and I'm saying, okay, well now you're kind of experiencing, what everybody else has seen.
Yeah.
You know, now that there's an election and maybe you're paying attention a little bit more to what's happening, but it didn't just start.
Yeah.
You know, and so that's my thing is that, you know, when I would come out strong or say a particular, oh, well, you're being mean. It's like, oh, I'm being mean.
Right. Right.
Oh, I'm being mean.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. The ones who tried to, you know, paint me as a Klans member.
Yeah.
And the ones who piled on and did the laughing reactions and emojis to it, they're just, you know, well, they're just voicing their opinion, right? Okay.
Sure, sure. So. Well, you know, it takes a lot to be able to transcend all that and continue to try and, you know, operate at the level of being a mayor. And mm-hmm. So where does that passion come from? Like where does that endurance come from?
As far as...
just being able to go through that. I mean, what do you attribute that to?
I mean, so without sounding too, you know, hyperbolic and such, I always like to go back to like when I started getting involved and passionate about politics and interested in politics. So before 2008, I was apathetic. I couldn't care less about, mm-hmm. you know, politics and world events and stuff like that. I was concerned with, you know, watching football and playing basketball and just, you know, living my life.
Right.
And so I always go back to, you know, why did I get into this? I didn't get into this to necessarily like climb the ladder or go to the fancy cocktail parties or, you know, make all these powerful buddies or anything like that. Like I've made a lot of good friends and, you know, I've had a lot of doors open and things like that. I've experienced a lot of really cool stuff, but that's not why I got into it, you know?
Yeah.
I'm much more comfortable. I can, you know, these fancy cocktail parties, I'll talk to the staff in the corner. You know, I feel more comfortable talking to them than, you know, the senator who has a bunch of people around him trying to, you know, get close to the real estate of power.
Yeah, sure.
I'm more comfortable at, you know, a metal show than the fancy stuff. But, I think that's, you know, kind of going back and remembering, you know, what I got into it for and, you know, also recognizing that, you know, when people, if people have an opinion about me, unless you're a very small group of people who I'm close with, cause I'm very introverted, and, you know, most people, unless you know who you are frankly, unless I have you on my Snapchat group chat, maybe, sure. you probably don't know the full me. And so, especially the folks who are so upset at me because of who they feel I am politically, 99% of them haven't even met me or had a conversation with me. Sure. I don't take it too personally because I know it's a straw man.
Yeah.
You know, even though it's frustrating, it could be, you know, it can make you mad sometimes, but I always try to remember at the end of the day, it's a straw man. These people aren't actually talking about me. Mm-hmm. They're talking about who they think I am.
Kind of caricatures at play, really. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the world is a stage.
Yeah.
That's what William Shakespeare said.
Well, you know, but being an introvert, I mean, it must have been, you know, just emotionally draining on you. I mean, just to kind of have to deal with that. And especially in the public sphere. I mean, an introvert that lives in the public sphere must be just, I mean, I mean, it must be terrifying every day waking up, having to look at your phone, dreading that. I mean, even it seems.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny. I was thinking about it the other day, you know, being Southern and being an introvert is a very interesting dynamic because you want to smile at everybody. And but, you know, at the same time, you're like, I'm just trying to be polite.
Yeah. But do you really want to like it?
being an elected official and a public figure, I guess, as an introvert is very interesting. I could see where, like, because I don't necessarily, like, if I'm out and about, I just kind of, you know, especially if I'm out, like, watching football and stuff, I'll talk to everybody, but I kind of just do my thing.
Mm-hmm.
And,
it probably makes you a great stoic though, because you can sit back and just not have to be at the front of the room and kind of listen to other people. And
well, I try to be, and I think that is actually a good, a big part of leadership is, kind of being that, being able to be that firm, stable rock, you know, when things get crazy, to not overreact or not get, you know, excited, and being able to kind of stay calm and deal with the situation. So yeah, I think being an introvert does, help you with in that, but you know, it's got its pros and cons. The interesting thing about, and I've heard this a lot about, like, other, whether it be a performer, an actor, or an artist or anything like that who is introverted, a lot of them, and I've actually found this myself, I'm more comfortable giving a speech in front of 300 people than I am sometimes in small talk, you know, because
that's understandable though, because small talk is intimate,
right?
You know, and so there's a different degree of vulnerability, you know, on stage. I mean, half the time on stage, so I've given some speeches to people on, say, a military base, a couple hundred people. And so the lights on the stage, sometimes it's often hard to see everybody. So the magnitude of the people that you're talking to kind of is hidden. And so that kind of helps as well. You know, oftentimes you only see like the first two, three rows.
Yeah, I think it's part of that, but it's also there's a sense of not necessarily control, but, you know, if I'm the one presenting. And, you know, different scenarios, whether it be like, you know, I would have breakfast with the mayor and I would take questions, you know, and I would banter a little bit back and forth there, but it wasn't, you know, just a open-ended, yeah. I guess is what I'm saying.
I see what you're saying.
And so,
that makes
you know,
a lot of sense.
As an introvert, a lot of times, like kind of that open-ended, you know, kind of social deep end, if you will, is what introverts kind of feel overwhelmed about.
Sure.
And so I feel like when you're, you know, on stage or, you know, addressing a crowd, it's more, okay, this is the scope that we're talking about.
Yeah.
This is what it is. And I'm
structure, presenting. You're the one talking, nobody's there to kind of conflict with what you're saying, talk for 20, 25 minutes.
And yeah. Or not necessarily like, and I can even add like debates to that. So even like if you're debating, but again, like it's not open-ended. It's more of a scope and a, yeah, like you said, maybe a structure. Maybe that's a good way of looking at it.
Yeah. So, okay. Well, I mean, being an introvert and, you know, being a mayor and having this passion for politics outside of the mayorship, what are you up to?
Well, so my organization is my main focus right now.
Go on, Chad. Yeah.
Citizens Alliance of Mississippi. I got some other stuff I'm working on as well, but Citizens Alliance of Mississippi, CAM, is my number one priority at the moment. And I'm really excited. It was kind of born out of, you know, a lot of stuff that's been happening, not only, you know, decades and decades of how I feel, you know, Mississippi needs to be, you know, have better, how can I put this, have better communication and we need to make sure that our voices are heard in Jackson and all of this. But, so I feel like that's been going on for a while, but, you know, it's frankly over the past few years, I'm just seeing more of a need, people just being frustrated with, what is going on in Jackson. I think the medical marijuana issue, you know, Initiative 65. I had somebody ask me about that. What do you feel like? Did your organization launch because of 65, or did all this happen because of 65, or anything? I say 65 was really just like a exclamation mark on everything that like a lot of people felt was wrong with Jackson. Like you take everything that happened with 65 from the very beginning of us, you know, campaigning and saying, hey, we're trying to get this, to them trying to put, or them putting 65A on the ballot, to, you know, passing, trying to pass other bills to undermine it, to it getting 74% to the Supreme Court, ruling unconstitutional and throwing the entire initiative process out after not saying anything for years.
On other laws that had passed under the same sort of process.
And so now, and now to the legislator, the legislature, you know, giving lip service to say, well, you know, we want what the, you know, the voter spoke. And it's like, well, yeah, they did. So stop trying to pass what y'all, what got defeated. And so it was funny because I was actually thinking and looking and thinking back. It's almost a blessing in disguise that they put 65A on the ballot and it was rejected so soundly, because now they can't even say, well, you know, voters didn't, voters only had one. No. They had a clear shot. They had free markets and they had protectionist red tape. The legislator wanted protectionist red tape. The people wanted free markets.
Yeah.
And they chose that 74%. And so now they're trying to impose that red tape on us again.
Well, and the big difference that I saw between the two, 65 and 65A, is that 65A had no implementation date. 65, they would have been required to start issuing cards this month.
Yep.
So that was when I read the two bills, like, okay, I'm just going to blast this out social media the entire time. You know, vote 65, not 65A, because 65A is just, it's a masquerade. It's a Trojan horse, you know, if you will.
Yeah.
And, I found it rather despicable.
It was,
honestly. So,
and it was frankly kind of insulting the way that the many legislators try to frankly insult our intelligence.
Oh man. I love what you're about to say.
I can go many directions there, but, they've spent decades killing marijuana-related bills, medical marijuana, recreational marijuana, other smaller, you know, just you know, stuff regarding CBD oil, stuff like that. It's been killed in committee for decades and decades, years and years and years. And so now many of these same politicians, once 65A got momentum, well, we want to pass a medical marijuana bill. Oh, so now you want to pass a medical marijuana bill.
Book of Matthew, you judge a tree by the fruit that it bears.
Yeah.
Okay. All this lip service doesn't mean anything. If you want to pass it, you'll pass it. Because they can very quickly get to a bipartisan issue and pass it.
Yeah.
Okay. When 74% of the citizens of the state want to do something, that's a political win across the aisle.
Yeah.
Make it happen. Like, you don't get a better handout like that. Like, that's a secure political win, bipartisanship, connects all the dots.
But see, here's where the rubber's really meeting the road, and this is where, frankly, I think my organization is going to frustrate a lot of the political class. It's because they're used to, you're absolutely right on that, but they're used to being insulated by their base, by their donors, to support. They don't care what the majority think. They care what their donors and you know, the small group who get them elected in their primary, a lot of times, not all the times, but sometimes, whatever they want, they're going to do. And a lot of times, I guess, you know, the way I describe it is, the general public, it's unfortunate that that there's a need for organizations like mine and other organizations who are like accountability type of organizations, because the average person doesn't have time. They're trying to live their life. They're trying to put food on the table. They're trying to, you know, get their kids in soccer practice and to school, and, you know, maybe go out to eat at a Mexican restaurant here and there. You know, they don't have time to keep up with all this BS.
Or drive 3 hours up to Jackson and bug.
And so, you know, and so politicians know that, and so their rhetoric is designed to mask what's really going on. You know, they'll name bills, they'll name bills a particular name in order just to get, in order, the Patriot Act.
Yeah.
You know, I mean that's national, but that's just one example.
Sure.
Oh, you're voting against this, you're not patriotic. You know, that's the kind of insinuations. But with my organization, I think that's why it's good, because we've introduced the our medical marijuana pledge program that is very simple. It just says that you won't support any type of licensing caps, and you won't support any type of minimum net worth requirements to own or operate in the industry.
Yeah. That's a big problem too.
Right.
And because they raised the barrier to entry, and now it just leads companies, and companies will, you know, maybe pass off some money to lobbyists and whatnot.
Yeah.
So
yeah, no question about it. So I feel like our pledge is extremely modest. You know, I've been talking to a lot of folks, and well, you know, I want to make sure that it's only for patients, or you know, that it's not so open that that you know this could happen or that could happen. And I tell them, look, we're going to disagree on some of the details, but let's at least keep the market open to everybody. And the fact that they keep throwing a lot of this, you know, excuses at me, it's like, y'all don't want to be held accountable. They say, almost all of them say they agree with our principles and agree with, you know, where we're coming from, but we got to wait and see what comes out of committee, or we got to, you know, wait and see how the bills, you know, we got to negotiate. It's like, if all of you agree with it, just hold the line.
Yeah.
It's that simple.
Yeah.
Just stand up for what you believe in. And I'm asking you for a very modest, you know, position. Just keep the market open.
What about the representatives that say represent these smaller, let's say, counties that gain income from people that are in jail for, say, nonviolent crimes that involve marijuana use? By making it legal in Mississippi, don't you run the risk of eliminating revenue that would be for those counties? And if so, don't they have maybe a monetary incentive to oppose this sort of legislation?
Yeah, and that's certainly a possibility. You know, when that's an industrial complex, whether it's military industrial complex,
sure. Or prison industrial,
prison industrial complex. Yeah. I mean, that's an industrial complex, and so. Yeah, I mean, there's going to be part of that. Now, how much that's weighing on their decision, you know, or any one individual's decision, I don't know. Mm-hmm. But my thing is I'm going to operate on face value. You know, if you're being pulled by that, then I'm not. It is what if I get evidence of it explicitly, I may call you out on that.
Sure.
But I'll give anybody the benefit of the doubt that what they're claiming their motives and intentions are really that. So, you know, I'll go into it. So I'll say, well, okay. I got to be careful about names and such, but I was talking about this issue with someone, and they talked about how they've talked to a lot of law enforcement folks throughout South Mississippi.
Mm-hmm.
And these law enforcement people expressed how they didn't want medical marijuana, and they were talking about all the issues that they've had with the drug war, and all of the problems that marijuana has had on their community. And so I said, well, what exactly are you talking about? I mean, you know, I do agree that I think sometimes that marijuana activists are a little too like, oh, it's the best thing in the world. It's going to cure this disease and that disease and all this.
There's a lot of charlatans.
There's a lot of charlatans. Yeah. And I try to tell them, look, I'm on your side. I agree marijuana is not this devil's lettuce like the reefer madness of 100 years ago. But let's not get out of hand here.
Yeah.
You know, that people still should be able to have the option and the choice.
Mm-hmm.
But let's not make it out to be something it's not. But so with that being said, I you know, poked a little bit more. And I said, well, tell me about some of the issues. And well, you know, gangs and this and this and that. Not a single one of the problems that they cited was about the marijuana plant itself and the effects it has. It was all about crime and all of the other stuff related to the drug war, you know? And so that's what I'm trying to get people to understand. They say, well, marijuana is bad. It, you know, there's gangs and people. Yeah,
that's correlation at best. Certainly not causation.
Right.
And oftentimes gangs that are organized for reasons outside of the drug use. The drug becomes the revenue stream for them. Mm-hmm. So because it's a black market. So if you so how do you eliminate a black market? By making it legal and tradable.
Right.
So then actually that would make the case that the gangs would have less of an opportunity to grow, to maintain, because the black market would no longer be viable.
Yeah, absolutely. Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, LEAP. It's an organization, really good. I'm not sure of their status now. I haven't heard much of them in a while, but, you know, they talked about how they said, well, let's talk about when we got legalized alcohol, when we decided alcohol prohibition wasn't working. Why did we do that? Did we do it because we wanted to encourage kids to get drunk before school? No. Well, we did it because obviously we wanted to encourage and we wanted more drunk drivers on the road, right? No, we didn't do it because any of those. The reason we got rid of alcohol prohibition is because prohibition doesn't work. It's as simple as that. During Prohibition, you have the mafia. You have organized crime controlling it. Outside of Prohibition, you have Anheuser-Busch, you know, these companies. So when you make it illegal like that, all you're doing is, like Milton Friedman said, when you look at the drug war from a purely economic standpoint, it's the job of the government to protect the black market for the criminals, because they're keeping honest companies from producing this product and not having to be in a market where the most violent are the ones that rise to the top.
Gotcha.
And Leap and that other, like one of the speeches they were talking about, they said, you know, what happens when a big drug cartel, like the leader of a drug cartel or something, dies? He gets shot, dies. Well, obviously what they do is with all other businesses, and then there's like a power vacuum. They go to court, right? All of the drug dealers, all of the lower men come in and present their case to the judge. They say, well, I've been moving this much weight,
yeah,
and,
right,
and all this, so I deserve, you know, this much. And so the judge, what he does is he makes a ruling and gives, you know, the proper amount of the drug trade to this. That doesn't happen. That happens in legal industries and legal products. But because of the government making it illegal, now the vacuum is determined by violence and shootouts in the street.
That's right.
So but when it comes to medical marijuana, I say, look, let's at least agree to get medicine to sick people. You know, we can debate a lot of this stuff, and I'm not saying we need to legalize every single drug and in the sense of just letting it open and selling it to, you know, in 7-Eleven or whatever the case may be. But at the same time, like, we need to have an honest conversation about does the drug war work, number one, and number two, let's at least recognize and give people the option of medicating in a way that they see fit.
Sure, and that makes a lot of sense. I do think that marijuana use by, let's say, the older population actually has makes real sense for the state as well, and I think it can actually save money. There was some great research out of Temple University. I think Catherine McClendon, if I'm not mistaken. But anyway, they evaluated older citizens that were exiting the workforce, right? And oftentimes due to pain, and those that were still in the workforce did not work as many hours because of pain. And yet they saw that in states where medical and even recreational marijuana was allowed, they saw that those populations were staying in the workforce longer. Mm-hmm. If they're staying in the workforce longer, then they're able to earn more of an income. And on average, they were working more hours. And I find that really interesting. Oh, one more. First of all, the working, it was at 13% of the population of, say, 60 and older were actually working more hours. And there was a 21% decline in self-reported, framed it, self-reported issues of pain, we'll say. Hmm. And so that tells me that it's the same thing as like getting a headache. You go to CVS, you get Tylenol, you're good to go. You don't have to sit and you know, deal with the opportunity cost of sitting in a waiting room or what have you. You can just self, you know, identify, medicate, so on and so forth. So I look at that as, well, I mean, you're increasing the purchasing power of people because they're able to earn more money. Earn more money allows them to spend more money. So the state recoups on say the goods that they buy. They're mm-hmm. able to be more self-sustaining, which reduces the sort of welfare burden on the state as well. And this is just from simply what could be happening starting this month.
Yeah.
You know, with Initiative 65. So I think obviously there's health benefits, but I mean, the health benefits are just the sort of, that's what's topical, right? That's mm-hmm. what you can see. But right. There are downstream effects. Don't want to say trickle-down economics, but rather maybe trickle-up. But the point is that somebody that's able to heal themselves.
It's not just in a vacuum.
Yeah, exactly. There's, yep. there's more than just like, hey, I feel good. Mm-hmm. You know, there's just more capability. And I think you can help a lot of people. There's people that are close to me that have issues, neurological issues, like, say, Parkinson's. Mm-hmm. And without marijuana, can't eat a bowl of cereal or soup, but with marijuana they can. And unfortunately, they've decided that their you know, lifestyle is better if they have marijuana, so they take the risk of buying marijuana,
right.
You know? And so of course there's a risk that this person who I care about very much might end up getting caught by the police. But from where I see it, I mean, if I was them, I'd probably do the same thing.
Right.
you know?
And it's that type of stuff that I feel like in creates distrust in government.
Yeah.
The drug war, you know, people want to talk about, you know, oh, this is racist and that racist. But the drug war was actually racist when it started, you know, and regardless of how or why it started, as far as the enforcement, you know, it's hit minority communities very, very hard.
Yeah.
And that the best way to describe it is, you know, all the statistics you look at shows white and black communities, you know, or wealthy or poor or whatever it is, they use drugs basically at the same rate. Mm-hmm. But, you know, these wealthy communities, it's a lot easier to hide and not be out in the open, where, you know, in the inner cities or you know, poor neighborhoods, it's you know, they're the ones having to take the risk to sell it, or they're the ones, you know, who it's out more on the open. And so it impacts certain communities more, regardless of what the intent was.
Exactly. And that's what I was going to bring up, is that you don't have to. To understand that it's a problem and that it disproportionately affects black communities and people of color, you don't have to really get down to like, well, was it a racist thing? It could just be just honest, naive policy decisions, right, by people at the time that didn't have the right science. I mean, the mid-20th century did not have the socioeconomic studies that we have today, right? A lot of it was just kind of guess, we think it'll work, misinformed, first-order principles. But clearly, it's affected those communities of people of color disproportionately. And to that end, I think that it's worth reconciling, at least by doing something like passing something as simple as medical marijuana.
Yeah. I mean, I agree 100%. And, you know, that goes back to, you know, just letting people own their lives, let people own their own health.
Yeah.
You know, not imposing. It's I just get frustrated at the sheer hypocrisy. If you're going to take a stance that, you know, you as the government or the government should have a say about what type of medicine you have. And, you know, I remember being up in Jackson and listening to them debate some of those other bills, and they were, you know, debating, well, should you only be able to smoke it if you have this condition, and, you know, it's like, weren't you the ones who spent 8 years talking about get government out of healthcare? You know, so do you want it's for some reason they think if Barack Obama is the one pushing it and it's from the national level, that, you know, that's offensive, having these bureaucrats, you know, dictator pop. That was the rhetoric, and I agree with them 100%. But for some reason, when it's taking place in Jackson by Republicans and they're dealing with marijuana, all of a sudden then it's justified. But it's the exact same principle.
I agree.
So I just get frustrated with the hypocrisy.
Yeah. And again, I see more benefits for the state. You know, I personally think that in a lot of ways, Mississippi's behind on some things, we'll say, right? We'll just leave it there.
That's fair.
Yeah. But, you know, again, like when we talked about East Ocean Springs during the election and development, and everyone wants like an affluent store like World Market and whatnot. And, but the problem is that the Mississippi laws kind of make it difficult for those companies to come in. So where we could have more affluent businesses, we're held off by organizations like the ABC that just because it's coming into the state, it's 27.5% tax, boom, on it immediately. Mm-hmm. And plus they have to handle all of the logistics lines. And they account for $200 million roughly a year. I've seen as high as $300 million, but you can look at a state like, say, Colorado, where they implemented their medical marijuana program, what, four or five years ago, right?
And from which state? Colorado?
Yeah. So their revenue from marijuana, I think, started in the realm of 30-40 million. Last year was 400 million. Mm. So I look at that and I say, okay, well, here's a great opportunity where the passing of Initiative 65 gives a greater economic modality for the state.
Yeah.
Insofar as with, let's just say, if it's $400 million that this can bring into the state, better healthcare, obviously, but we could get rid of the ABC, allow these more affluent companies to come in and proliferate more affluent businesses that might attract more higher earning people to the state as well. Yeah. I see that as a net gain also. And of course, it costs $100 million a year to run the ABC. Mm-hmm. So we eliminate that cost as well.
Yeah. Yeah. ABC is a racket.
Yeah.
It's very cartel like, right?
It is.
If you want to sell in my territory, like you got to come through me, and I'm going to attach a 27.5% tax. Like that's straight out of a movie, man.
So I was I actually testified at a committee. I can't remember which committee it was. Hank Zuber was the chairman, I believe.
Okay.
I've
been trying to get him on.
Yeah, you should. He's good. But a couple years ago, and it was about alcohol laws. And most of who was in there to oppose the loosening of the laws were existing liquor companies or you know, and so and that, well, you know, if you all these chains and basically they were arguing, well, we're going to have competition. It's like, it's not these representatives and senators' job to legislate and regulate your competition out the market. It's your job to provide better customer service or better prices or better quality or a combination of all of it to make people choose your business over the other. It's really as simple as that.
It's that simple. I do think that looking out for those businesses, though, according to Mississippi law, you can only have one liquor license in the state. So I would like to see that go away as well, because you don't have the ability for a small business to franchise. And it even affects large companies. Winn-Dixie, you know, the liquor store here in Ocean Springs is the only Winn-Dixie liquor store in the state. And it was in Biloxi until that one closed out, I think, on Pass Road, right? If I'm not mistaken, so. I could have that wrong. But yeah, I mean, so I do see if that's what they're talking about, like, hey, we can't compete with a larger company because we're just a small business, then okay, great. I hear you. You can now franchise, you know?
And it's exactly that type of, and see, that's what I remember talking to folks about it so much and saying it was so, I don't know if ironic the right word or so just poetic justice, maybe, that, you know, when 65 passed before they ruled it unconstitutional.
It was amazing that it passed.
Yeah, it was. And so alcohol would have been, regarding just the medical portion of it, you know, alcohol was in a lot of ways very, very restrictive and had a lot of, and so I was like, you know, we have this open marijuana market, medical marijuana market, where, you know, businessmen can go into business without having to ask Mother May out of Jackson, and then you still got these protectionist policies on alcohol. It's just very ironic that it kind of jumped like that. But and you're exactly right. That's and I remember you know, discussing that up there at the hearing and talking about how you know, Ocean Springs, we want to get Publix, you know, we want to get Trader Joe's, we want to get all these different companies with these very cool cool unique business model, but because of these alcohol laws, it keeps them away.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, and I remember in that hearing also, it was so frustrating, and I almost had to, you know, this goes to show why, and also I'll tell, you know, not only younger people, just everybody in general, you got to get involved with politics, because the people who you send often don't, they're out of touch. And they don't know your values. So in that hearing, they were talking about, well, you know, if the alcohol laws are loosened and the children see liquor or wine or whatever it is in the grocery store, or that, you know, they're it's going to be harder or this and that. And I'm like,
watch the music videos your kids watch.
Yeah.
Okay. They're very much aware there's alcohol.
Well, yeah. And not only that, but it was so funny. And I almost, like, I had to keep myself from being too, like, sarcastic or not even laugh, but in the hearing I said, look, I understand you want to, you know, you want to protect your children, you want to make sure they're not exposed to, you know, whatever it is that you don't approve of. You should have that right. I said but let me just put it this way. I'm from the Gulf Coast. I've been going to Mardi Gras since I was
a little bitty. Right.
Yeah. Now, obviously, I'm from Ocean Springs, and Ocean still Springs isn't New Orleans.
It's still not an alcohol-free zone.
It's still not an alcohol-free zone, and you know, I have family in Louisiana. I've been to the, you know, Mardi Gras parades over there. Yeah. You've gone, you know, and so that's what I told him. I'm like, look, I've been to Mardi Gras. I'm from the coast. And you know, I remember when I was younger walking through casinos to go to the restaurants.
Yeah.
You know, I remember
they
had to, some of them would put like a little thing on you or something, you know, you have to stay with your parents and walk through the floor and
then
you
eat and get dropped off at Kids Quest and your kids go gamble.
Absolutely.
Come on now.
And I brought that up too. And I said, you know, and I'm not an alcoholic. I may have an annual gambling budget of $50.
Yeah.
You know, like I don't, so your fears are unfounded. They really are.
Yeah, I think they fail the a practical thought experiment certainly, but yeah, I mean that's kind of the common thing is you go back to the kids, like, do you, first of all, if you have this marijuana bill and it starts out as medical marijuana, I mean it's not going to open the floodgates to marijuana everywhere, and even if it's recreational, it's not going to be without regulation, and I'm sure the legislators are going to curb the demand by taxing it, you know, mm-hmm. price indicates scarcity. So I definitely think that there's fear mongering, you know,
we'll say, but
when I hear that also, I think, okay, well, you can't have one without the other. Okay. So your fear is the children, maybe the future of your kids. And I say, well, the future of your kids are brighter because of this potential revenue stream. What if the revenue stream brings in money to where all kids that have a C average can be subsidized to go to a state college? That's a net gain for the state.
Right.
You know, I mean, you can look at all sorts of problem statistics, crime, poverty, all these things are all heavily affected by an increase in the education base of that population. So it stands to reason that if we focus on that and finding ways to make that more affordable and attainable for people in the state, then those problems will slowly recede as well, hopefully. Now, I also want to say that alcohol and marijuana, back to Colorado, their alcohol sales didn't really plummet. In fact, they account for about $50 million a year in revenue, despite having a boon in, say, the craft market, which is largely driven by the people going there for the marijuana. So that's unaffected as well. But the point is there is that $50 million last year, $400 million. Okay, eight times. You have the opportunity, potentially, if the same effect happened here, you would have eight times the annual revenue that the state brings in for alcohol to do what with? Whatever you want.
Right.
Pay raises, you know, for like teachers, for first responders, law enforcement, all these things. I mean, I don't see a downside.
There's not.
I don't.
Yeah. And, you know, that, again, that goes back to, it's definitely all upsides. I mean, well, and I say all upsides, you know, again, marijuana is not a plant that's going to, you know, cure every disease or anything like that. But you could even, if we take this conversation and do it back to when they were trying to discuss whether alcohol should be legal or not.
Yeah, we knew the same things about each substance and they both emerged overnight, which one would be legal.
Right. And, and not only that, but, you know, it's not about marijuana being this great thing or necessarily this bad thing. It's about just economics and understanding that when there's supply or when there's demand, there's going to be supply. And regardless of how much you don't like it, pushing it into a black market is
this always the wrong thing.
Always the wrong thing.
Yeah.
Now go out, you know, preach against it. Go wave signs on Highway 90 about how people need to stop smoking it.
Advocate it. Sure.
Go knock on doors if that's your prerogative, but don't use government to force people to stop or do your bidding.
Yeah. I mean, the simple fact is you can't legislate ethics.
No.
If there's an ethical principle about it, then that should be self-evident. And if it's not, then that's where advocacy comes in my opinion.
Yeah.
So
absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. You have a right to preach against something or talk about something, but not use other agents to enforce your beliefs.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. So where are the allies for this organization? Aside from just people like you and me who just see it, not just a center, because as you said, it's not centered purely on the medical marijuana, but perhaps as a catalyst initiative, you know, 65, given that what 74% of voters voted in, are there other organizations that are kind of on the side of this trying to find momentum as well? And
you know, there's a lot of, there's other organizations out there fighting the good fight and you know, other individuals just within their scope. I think everybody has their own strengths and weaknesses and, you know, things that they're good at and obviously different locations. You know, I'm here on the coast, different things. But so there's other organizations out there who are doing it. The Mississippi Medical Marijuana Association is really good. The We Are 74 group. That's very grassroots. You know, they have a lot going on. That's very it's people of all different perspectives, whether, you know, conservative, liberal. And so that's very just grassroots and folks who are just, you know, not necessarily politically the most politically involved or connected, I should say, but just supposed to are folks who are passionate. And so, and then the, you know, association is really understands the business side of it and works with a lot of, you know, different companies and such. And so my organization, you know, is good at just, you know, political organizational and communications and advocacy and stuff like that. So everybody has their, you know, like I said, their strengths and weaknesses, you know, and obviously other, you know, elected officials or, you know, influencers, if you will, that that support it. So the way I like to describe it is just more of a kind of a loose network that, you know, I've connected with and worked with folks on this issue who will disagree on other stuff down the road. But I think it's important to when you can find something that you can agree with, but work towards that.
Yeah.
And so that's what I've been trying to do. I'm trying to think. There was a lot of different groups. The Mississippi Minority Cannabis, the Mississippi, what is it? Mississippi Minority Cannabis Association.
Okay.
I hope I'm getting that right. They did a presentation at one of the hearings, the Senate hearings I was at. Really, really good. I've been talking to them. They shared my op-ed I did. They really understand the need to open the market, you know, and what they talked about is, you know, they represent a lot of, you know, black owned businesses. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they talked about how whenever you have all this regulation, like I believe it was in Oklahoma, or not Oklahoma, what was it? Arkansas, that it it forced them, it regulated them out of the business. And so they talked about the need to, you know, like, again, with our pledge, not having any minimum net worth requirements, not having licensing caps, mm-hmm. You know, and just in general, lowering the, lowering how hard it is to get into the business. That sure. only helps everybody.
Right.
And so,
right.
you know, whether you're, you know, a black owned business who may not have a lot of generational wealth, or you're a, you know, a wealthy businessman who just wants to throw around a bunch of money, you should be able to have access to the market.
Yeah, for sure. And I've run into a couple of people that I know that have businesses on the Gulf Coast, and they've found that trying to get into their perspective or their respective industries, if you will, down on the coast, there's a barrier to entry that's not just economic, but knowledge based, you know? Yeah. And so they're trying to get into it, and it's as if there's kind of old money gatekeepers in there.
Oh yeah.
You know,
the gatekeepers.
So,
yeah.
Yeah. And so kind of being restrictive to people. And I think a state like Mississippi needs to be hyper aware of those sorts of things and really take a step back and look at where those things might be. Because, you know, if you are a true capitalist, then you want more people to have access to the market.
Yeah.
That's just what you want. It's just better for business that way.
Yeah.
Because there's more experiments of opportunity and for innovation. So
I'm an unapologetic capitalist.
Yeah, there you go.
I will not apologize for supporting capitalism.
Are you a reader of Ayn Rand?
No, I mean I've obviously read her stuff and
aware of it.
And,
yeah,
studied it, but I will say I think she's misunderstood a little bit.
I do too, yeah.
But
yeah.
You know, she makes some good points on, you know, certain specifics.
Yeah, yeah, within her.
You I don't know if I buy
philosophy.
I don't know if I buy everything she's selling.
Right, right. I really like the idea that you know, selfishness is a moral good, and that it ensures that you're not to be taken, not unwavering selfishness, but
right.
but making sure that you're taken care of ahead of somebody else because it's really. The problem that we talked about at the beginning is that you want freedom, but not the responsibility.
Right.
And so by selfishness, you're taking the responsibility to make sure that you're taken care of so that you're not a burden on somebody else. I think that's the moral principle there that lies therein. Of course, it doesn't go down easy. It takes a lot of discussion.
I agree. Yeah, it takes a lot to kind of unwrap it. And it kind of takes the idea of altruism and I don't know if standing on its head is the right way to put it, but
I think so. It's
yeah.
The way she describes it, it's the opposite end.
Yeah.
Know?
The way that I've kind of looked at it, and I don't know if this is exactly would be the interpretation that she would agree with, but the way that at least I have, what I personally have taken out of it is that, you know, I'm going to support and have value judgments based on my own values and perception, you know, and yes, that may be influenced or shaped maybe by those who are I willingly let around me and such. But but I'm going to support something or not support something, or anything like this type of stuff, because it's what I feel is my morals to support, not because society is forcing that.
Sure, sure.
Yeah. And so I think that that's, and you really have to talk through that because it gets a little clumsy.
Oh yeah.
But I would kind of look at it is, I want to help people. Like I want to give to a charity because my value says that the money that I'm giving is better spent by the money that I have that is my right to do with. I'm willing to give it because my values and my judgment says that it's better for them to have this particular money to fulfill their mission.
Sure.
And I'm doing it because I feel that that's my virtues, not because of I'm releasing my autonomy to the collective. And so that's how I kind of take it out of
yeah,
it.
Yeah, I'll give my kind of view on that in terms of charity. Like so let's say that you give to a charity and you decide to give to this charity, right? Time, money, resources, whatever the case may be, right? You feel good about it, right? Could we call that pleasure then? I got pleasure from doing that. Okay, so then if that's the case, then we can take a hedonistic perspective in that it's selfish of you to seek that pleasure. Yeah. But it is charity.
Yeah.
So that's that would be within the philosophical realm of Ayn Rand, is that you're, you know, it's a moral good because for you, or for one that believes that they get pleasure from helping others, that's a moral good, and so they're chasing that, yeah. to seek that pleasure as a hedonist.
Yeah,
you know. So, yeah. But
it's very interesting. That's why I love philosophy, because it's a lot of ways to.
It's thoughts about thoughts, man.
Yeah, it's thoughts about thoughts. It's a way of looking at something and kind of, you know, turning it on its head and tackling issues and kind of getting to an area from numerous different ways.
Yeah.
And so I really like it. And you know, kind of the bookend on that, what I've always said just in general, and not necessarily revealing, you know, specific Ayn Rand or anything like that, but I always tell people, you know, who are very kind of just, what's the word? Just very bleeding hearts, you know, caring about people and stuff. Yeah. I always tell them, look, it's good and I'm happy. And that's very admirable that you're somebody who really cares about others, who wants to, you know, even, you know, not look after yourself and martyr yourself in a way to help others. That's great. But at the end of the day, if you can't stand on your own two feet and take care of yourself, then you're no good to others either. You can't help others. And so
you need a burden.
Yeah. You need, exactly. Don't become a burden trying to help others.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, for sure. Mm-hmm. Well, that makes sense. Okay. So what's next for the organization? What does the organization need? Where, you know, what are the next movements here?
Best thing you could do right now is to go to teamcam.org/citizen and sign that pledge. That's the main thing we're doing right now because, you know, like I said, they're talking about this medical marijuana bill. They have, you know, leadership pushing on them to say what they want to do. Lobbyists from a lot of different places.
Sure.
Yeah. telling them what they want. You know, like I said, their base, their donors, or whoever it is, telling them what they want. And so what I keep telling people is, you know, they say, well, you know, the 74% people spoke for it and they would be a fool to go against it. Yes, but we have to make sure that they understand our voices are, number one, we're united and we're crystal clear about our intent and what we're going to stand and not stand for. And number two, and more importantly, that we're going to remember you know, their votes, and we're going to remember how they stand on this issue. And that's going to come into play come election time.
Sure.
So, you know, you got to sign the pledge and you got to just go to teamcam.org. You can look at our website there, but, so we're really focusing on this right now. We're expecting a special session. I'm hearing conflicting things. There might not be a special session.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously we're working on that. Once it becomes clear that this is not going to be a special session or we get past it, we're going to be putting together an accountability scorecard. We're going to look at bills, some of the bills that we're either anticipating or had already been discussed or introduced, and you know, kind of grade those and say, okay, we, you know, if you vote for this, you get a thumbs up, or vote for that, you're going to get a thumbs down.
Mm-hmm.
You know, grade everybody based on that.
And that's thumbs up, thumbs down is the perspective, what, based on their political stance?
Based on their vote on particular bills. And so we'll identify, and obviously with, people can agree to disagree, but we're going to identify vote bills that we feel is important. You know, not every, we're not going to score every single vote,
sure,
but you know, the big significant bills that we feel is, you know, they need to take a hard stance on or whatever. You know, and a lot of this, it's kind of fluid. I got to see what comes out, and I got to, sure, you know, talk to people and you know, the devil's in the details. But once we identify those bills as, you know, this one's good, this one's bad,
yeah,
we'll put all that out accordingly.
Gotcha. And I do want to underscore this point is that it's not an organization that's purely about medicinal marijuana. It just medical seems marijuana to be the most obvious thing right now. I mean, again, 74% of people voted for this and they found a way to get rid of it. And
right,
also identifying their own hypocrisy in the process, you know? So it seems like a great launching point as well.
Yeah. And, you know, we're really not thinking too much in those terms. You know, for us, it's just a, you know, again, where people feel like they don't have a voice in their government. They're just frustrated about what's going on in Jackson. You know, I'm going to make sure that people know crystal clear about, you know, what's happening in Jackson.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm going to be in there following what's happening in committee. You know, I'm going to make it the swamp, you know, they talk about in DC, there's a swamp in Jackson, but I want people to really understand, you know, what that means. The swamp's real muddy. It's you can't see in the water.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's kind of, it's, and I'm glad the swamp, they talk about like the swamp, because that's what happens when you get into these committees. There's 174, I believe, senators and representatives in Jackson. It's hard to know the sausage, you know, what you don't want to know how the sausage and legislation's made. I mean, nobody knows what deals for sure are being made or
this
is being included in this bill because of this or that or that. Well, they're not going to be operating in the shadows anymore.
Right.
That's what they need to understand. The days of operating in the shadows and being able to go to Jackson away from your constituents and, you know, be in the Capitol and do all these deals and, you know, preaching about how bad marijuana is while you go in Jackson and get drunk on the taxpayers' dime.
Right.
I'm exposing it all. All that's over with.
Good.
I've seen, being mayor, I've seen corruption from Jackson.
Mm-hmm.
And
again, I've heard some stories, you know, so just even along the coast. And, you know, it's not like any governmental body is immune to that. I mean, Moss Point went through that with their mayor, you know, so and that's just down the road from us, you know.
Yeah.
So but yeah, look, Shay, I had a great time talking to you, man.
Yeah,
and you're welcome anytime. I wish you the best of luck in this organization. How can people get in touch? Now you mentioned teamcam.org, mm-hmm, right? How can people get in touch with you if they'd like to?
Follow me on all social media. I think at Shay Dobson is Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I've gotten lucky and got my name.
There you go.
But yeah,
he's got to work on that blue check mark now.
Yeah, I know. It's impossible. I've tried to get verified, but I don't know what the deal is. But
yeah.
So at Shay Dobson on all of those. Go to Citizens Alliance website or our social medias as well. At Citizens of MS.
Okay.
On Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, I believe. I hope I'm not. Yeah, I'm pretty sure that's it. And
either way, I'll put on the website. You know, we'll get it all tagged, all that good stuff.
Good deal. So. Yeah, and or you can email me at shay@teamcam.org.
Okay.
Yep.
Awesome. Well, again, Shay, good luck to you. Thanks for stopping by. Had a blast.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, all right.
Appreciate it.
All right, everybody. We'll see you. Everybody, I hope you enjoyed that episode. I certainly did. And if you want to follow more and hear more, you can check us out on any of the major podcasting platforms. We're on Apple, Spotify, Google, Stitcher, everything. You can also follow us on social media. I've got a YouTube channel, so search for Shop and Chivalry. Subscribe there. We also have Instagram. Just look for Shop and Chivalry. Twitter at Shop and Chivalry and Facebook.com/Shop and Chivalry. You can also shoot us an email at administration@Shop and Chivalry if you'd like to be on the show or suggest somebody or give more direct feedback. You can also find that link on our website, shopandchivalry.com, where I have all my ramblings about the show, what the show means to me, that particular episode. I've got a blog, other media on there as well as embedded players. So you can play the shows and the videos for those that have video as well. So again, thank you for all the love. I appreciate all the feedback. It's been wonderful. I'm having a great time. And yeah, much love. All right.
See you.